This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Wednesday, time to talk about your health. And we have all been enjoying watching the Olympics. And it is no surprise when we look at some of the absolutely incredible feats they are performing that many of them get injured. And some of them are competing either while they are injured or very, very soon thereafter. And I'm thinking, you know, in some of those cases, I think maybe they are risking permanent damage. We've already seen the disastrous consequences of Lindsey Vonn deciding to race with a torn ACL. Mark McMorris competing, it seems like a day or so after getting a concussion. So I would like the panel's take on that and also the questions for the rest of us, especially as we age. If you continue to participate in sports, to work out, chances are you'll be injured at some point. So how do you know if you've taken enough time? What is enough time and what is too much time? Because if you don't take enough, then you will likely get re-injured. But if you take too much time, then you'll lose more muscle mass and maybe also the desire to keep participating. Also, some big advances, very interesting on pancreatic cancer. For the longest time, my understanding was that there was no immunotherapy for pancreatic cancer, which is just about the hardest to treat, hardest to detect. There have been some advances in early detection. We've talked about anti-cancer vaccines, but according to what I just saw, there is an immunotherapy that works well for a small subset of patients who have what is called borderline resectable pancreatic cancer. We'll talk about that. I think that is very exciting. And speaking of vaccines, so a lot of bad news about vaccine development in the United States. RFK Jr., anti-vaxxer or vaccine hesitant, whatever you want to call him. So about a week ago, there was news that the Food and Drug Administration in the States wasn't even going to review Moderna's latest mRNA flu vaccine. And RFK has the biggest bee in his bonnet about mRNA vaccines, which are holding out so much hope for so many things. And just about an hour ago, we saw a reversal. So I'm curious what is up with that. If you have questions, 866-744-740, that is texts, and that is the long distance phone line and our local phone lines available now, 416-360-0740.
Now, time for The Medical Record.
And now I'd like to welcome Dr. Malcolm Moore, medical oncologist at the Princess Margaret, former head of BC Cancer, Dr. Fahad Razak, general internist at St. Mike's, and Canada Research Chair in Healthcare Data and Analytics at the U of T, and Dr. Elisa Naiman, a family doctor practicing in Toronto. Hello and welcome.
Hi, Libby.
So
hi there.
Hi, let's start with the pleasant conversation first about the Olympics. So with these athletes who are playing either with injuries or very shortly after, this is being received as a really good thing. And I'm wondering if that's a bad example, because I think they risk permanent injury. Malcolm?
Well, If we look at, first of all, if we look at Lindsey Vonn, which is the highest profile one, when she was injured, they listed all of the injuries she's had over her career. It's unbelievable. She's already had a knee replacement. She's fractured her arm. She's fractured her leg. And so there's no question that when she gets not too much older, she'll have difficulty with walking. But she's put a stress on her body that very few, if any, people have ever done. So I don't really think we can draw any examples, particularly in the Zoomer population, about somebody like her, who's an elite athlete, very well trained, well supported, and how those of us who are aging and get a sports injury should deal with it. It's interesting, but as I said, her case is just so unusual and exceptional that I don't think we can draw any general conclusions. I do think the one point that's very relevant for the old, for, you know, there's lots of active older people.
Yeah.
People get sports injuries. It's very important, as you said, when you get older, not to stop completely because things stiffen up, particularly things like frozen shoulders. If your shoulder's injured, if you don't move it, that's why it's important to see a physio and start to work on a program to start to rehab yourself in a sensible way.
Yeah, people, as you know, amateur I don't even know if I'd call my peer group athletes, but, if you keep active playing, you're going to get injured. Some people, they don't want to cancel a game. They play injured and they get re-injured. Alisa, do you see that in your practice?
Libby, you're talking about me.
You're not older.
I'm always injured. I always like to play sports and do things, and I'm constantly injured, and it's one thing or another. It just goes from one injury to the next. I've had a bad shoulder since the end of July, and I kept playing through it because I didn't want to miss my pickleball. Then eventually it just got so bad that my strategy wasn't working. And by October, I was having a lot of functional problems, like problems with just like my day-to-day activity with using my right arm, which is my dominant arm. And then I had to really cut back. So I cut back to once a week, which still was not good. Because, everybody plays and you feel this pressure to play.
Yeah.
Even though I'm a doctor and I should know better. But I continued to play, and then it progressively got worse, and then I had to just not do anything. And it's slowly getting better. But, it's this struggle of like wanting to be active and the importance of exercise. There's nothing better than people can do, but that's suffering injuries. And I've told you that when I play pickleball, every single person has some type of support or brace on, either because they have an injury or they're trying to prevent something. So it's quite fascinating to watch. So what these athletes do is not surprising. I'm sure there's intense pressure. You talked about the skier. So he had a concussion, he had pelvic bruising, and he had an abdominal strain. And a week after this injury, he competed today. Unfortunately, he didn't do as well as he's done in the past Olympics. But I just think the pressure to compete is so immense. And I think, I have lots of patients that are these weekend warriors, people who played softball, baseball when they were young, who now their shoulders are just a disaster. So it's like, if you do nothing, you're going to be in pain and not have, it's not good. And if you do something, you're going to be struggling and having a hard time. So people have to find the right balance, and you do have to be careful, because if you go back too early from injury, you're going to strain something else and you're going to have other injuries. Have I learned this myself? No, but this is what I tell people to do.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that one of the things Malcolm was trying to say is that if you get injured, well, you probably have to do exercises, but possibly not play the game that you probably love and you have friends doing. And Fahad, we've talked about older people, but what about this as an example to younger people about doing things that are basically dangerous? Do you worry about that?
Yeah, there is something for younger people in this as well, which is that, look, there is a spectrum in sports, and we know that certain sports are much higher risk for injury, and certain physical activities are much higher risk for injury. For example, we see a lot of injuries for people who bicycle through the city. many people who bicycle through the city don't wear helmets. So there is, you know, younger people also, there is something to learn here, which is that these injuries can be quite consequential when they happen. If you speak to a typical eMERGE doc in the city, they'll say, you know, what do I see people in with? They'll give you a list. And it's the things you would expect. And at the same time, you see that people aren't necessarily protecting themselves. So I think the message here is the activity, it's the remaining very active, very important. Injuries are a part of activity. So don't be surprised that they're going to happen. Mitigate risk where you can, be reasonable. So if you're out on a city street in Toronto, you should be wearing a helmet on your bicycle. And once you have an injury, targeted recovery is important. So absolutely leaving things, not the right answer. You're going to develop other problems, but targeted under guidance of ideally a physiotherapist or a physician, at least in the early days, to give you a sense of how to navigate the pain, but also to remain active is very, very important.
Mm-hmm. And when to go back in my regular Sunday game, somebody was just back from an injury and she came on the court and she said, OK, you can't drop shot me today.
yeah, that's right. Be kind to your peers. That's
well,
right.
Yeah, I'm not saying that we didn't. So moving along, Malcolm, so this development in a certain subset of patients of pancreatic cancer, my understanding was there was no immunotherapy that was effective. And now it looks like there is for a certain group of people.
Sadly, Libby, that's not a correct conclusion from that study. The study of itself is a good one. It's actually done by a colleague of mine who I work with in the U.S. So it's a well-done study. But it's in clinical trials, there's three kinds of studies. What we call phase one, which means you're testing a new combination, in this case, immunotherapy, chemotherapy, and surgery, just to see if it can be given safely and maybe to draw some conclusions about whether it's worth pursuing. You then get into what are called comparative studies, phase two, and then phase three, where you compare that treatment to an identical population of patients who get the standard treatment. This was just a small study of a subset of patients with resectable pancreatic cancer who got immunotherapy and chemotherapy before their surgery. And the conclusions that are drawn in the article are actually not the conclusions that the authors drew. Oh. The authors just basically concluded that, yeah, you can do this safely. It doesn't seem to improve survival, but there may be a subset of patients who achieve some benefit. We just don't know how to pre-select those.
Oh, because...
And we've done some very big studies in pancreatic cancer, and other than about 3% of the patients who have this specific marker for immunotherapy, immunotherapy is of no value in the remaining 97%. So... This is just a very early study but the conclusions that are drawn in the article are not the conclusions of the author, and they're not the conclusions. This is not an advance. It's just an exploratory study, and it'll have to be tested further, unfortunately.
So they just made up the conclusion? Because, I mean, what I read was it's specifically said that some people with borderline resectable pancreatic cancer that had great results.
Well, but they didn't compare, they didn't have a matched group of patients who got the standard treatment. The reality is, even with standard treatment, there are a subset of people with resectable pancreatic cancer who do better than average, right? That's just the nature of oncology treatment. So I just think that this is, honestly, this should never have been in an article. I think this is one of these throwaway journals that it was in. And basically, this is a very early study, and I'm sure the first author who I know would say, you know, we did this, you can do it safely, and you know, but to draw any conclusions, we have to do further studies. So this kind of annoys me because I think if there's been lots of true advances in cancer therapy, and I think when things that are not actual advances are announced, I think it's distressing to patients. They think there's something there. Turns out there isn't. So
I just think we need to have a dose of skepticism when we hear about some of these breakthroughs in the media.
Well, thanks for that, because I certainly would not have picked up on that. Just one more question before we move along here, Malcolm. And you said that there's people with a certain mutation, 3%. What mutation is that?
It's called microsatellite instability or defective mismatch repair. So it's a defect in the tumor that causes difficulties in repairing DNA damage. And for some reason, and we see it in 3% of pancreatic cancer, 10% of colon cancer. And in those patients, immunotherapy is highly effective.
Yeah, I remember hearing...
The test is routinely available. It's done on all tumor samples, so we always test for that.
Well, I remember hearing about it, and you know, when I was about to go on immunotherapy, and the people who had that had what they called a complete response. So, yeah.
Yeah, those people are highly sensitive to immunotherapy.
Okay, well, good for them. That's good news for them. Moving right along, so Fahad, this topsy-turvy decision by the FDA on this new mRNA flu vaccine, and because they've been pulling back on their support of mRNA vaccines, I gather that a lot of research has stopped because, you know, a lot of it was funded in the United States. So what do you make of this latest twist?
Yeah, this is bad. It is building on a backdrop, as you said, of a year of assault by the Health and Human Services and RFK Jr. against vaccines in one form or another. In August of last year, more than 20 projects, $500 million of mRNA vaccine research was just suddenly discontinued under his direction. He's made many, many half-truth type statements. We've talked about this before, where little kernel of truth adds in something false about vaccines that he's extended out to really dissuade people in many ways from getting vaccinated. He summarily disbanded the Vaccine Advisory Committee that they had in the United States and then put a pediatric cardiologist in charge of vaccine policy for the United States. So someone who I'm sure is a great cardiologist for kids, but is not a vaccine specialist. And that individual, Kirk Millen, in an interview just last month said, well, maybe it's time for kids to get infected with measles and things like that again, because you know what? We may be able to treat it better than we were 50 years ago. So let's see what happens. That was his position. So listen, this is by the statement of former FDA commissioners in the United States. This is the most significant dismantling of U.S. vaccine policy ever to have occurred. And the consequence, unfortunately for us in Canada and for the rest of the world, is they are an engine of innovation and funding. So when they summarily pull back funding or approval processes for vaccines, like what nearly happened here and was rescued at the very last minute, it signals to industry that this is a highly volatile area of innovation. And industry has to be profitable. They have to be profitable. So they can't continue in areas which are like this, which are volatile. They're going to move their efforts elsewhere. And of course, the great tragedy is this is an incredibly promising technology. We saw what happened 9 months from the start of vaccine development to a fully functional, highly effective vaccine for COVID. People like me who were interviewed, we said it was going to be years to get a vaccine. Promising advances in the use of this from everything from other infections to cancer. All of that is going to be disrupted by these moves. So highly tragic. I think it signals a shift away from the U.S. being the lead for this kind of innovation. It is, I hope, something that other countries, you know, if you think about Prime Minister Carney's middle power speech, the idea that other countries could band together to potentially support this kind of work. So with the Canadas, the Germanys, the UKs, could we support this kind of work in a way that would supplicate what the U.S. historically would have done?
Middle powers, middle money. the other thing that I found interesting, so they changed their minds this morning. They said, yes, we will review it because of changes from Moderna. And I'm wondering, I didn't have time to read the whole thing. What I read was that they're looking at getting it approved for older people. And one of the things I've been hearing from some of these people who sound like borderline conspiracy theorists is we should never have vaccinated kids, really, just to protect old people, and maybe old people should be vaccinated. So, Alisa, do you think that's what this is about?
No, I think this is about that there has been a shift within the administration against the mRNA vaccine. And it seems that previous discussions that Moderna had with the FDA in terms of this study, that the government was okay with the study design. Their issue had to do with their control group, and that was why it was initially declined. And then in further, because they Moderna used a control group of a regular flu vaccine as opposed to a high dose for somebody over the age of 65. So I think this just represents within the narrative of what the current administration is doing in terms of their hesitation and their anti-vaccination status that they have. Let's use this year in the flu season as an example. It's based on old technology, and so they had to design the vaccine from what was circulating within the Southern Hemisphere. Well, by the time it got to us, the virus had significantly mutated, that we lost effectiveness of the drug. Well, if it's an mRNA vaccine, it doesn't take as long to produce the vaccine, so we'll have a better match. So this is something that, unfortunately, because of COVID, mRNA vaccines have been politicized, and it's really unfortunate because it would be a very effective tool that will help us in the future. It's actually very sad.
There was, again, some news on the use of low-dose aspirin. We've seen that it was, for a long time, prescribed to prevent cardiovascular disease. That was debunked, and now there's another study debunking it for eventually lowering cancer risk, Malcolm.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting field, and it's been highlighted actually by the U.S. president, who takes aspirin every day for its cardiovascular risk, and that explains his bleeding, apparently. But this all started probably 10, 15 years ago with an observation that from studies that people who were taking aspirin for arthritis seemed to have a lower incidence of colon cancer. And since that time, there's been a lot of very large studies to try and test this. And the general conclusion is that there is a small benefit, but the benefit is only in people who've been taking aspirin for 15 to 20 years.
Wow.
You don't see a benefit after 5 or 10 years, or at 5 or 10 years, the difference in incidence of colon cancer is less than 1%. So it's probably not clinically meaningful, because aspirin does have side effects, bleeding, gastric ulcers. And one of the important things here is that when we're talking about aspirin for these kind of indications, we're talking about low dose aspirin, the 80 milligram tablets, which you can buy in the drugstore, not the regular dose, which is either like 325 or 650. Because that's associated with a higher incidence of side effects.
And how's that?
And then the most recent study, what it basically showed is that for people over 70, there really is no value to taking aspirin as a preventative in terms of colon cancer. And that makes sense in a way if you think that the only benefit is after you've been doing it for 20 years. So, you know, if you're starting when you're 70, any benefit, small as it is, you're very unlikely to derive it.
And has it been tested in other cancers or just colon cancer?
It has been tested in other cancers. Most of the data is from colon cancer. And like I said, the degree of benefit is small. And it raises this issue of statistics. So, for example, if your incidence of getting colon cancer in the next 10 years is 2%, and you decrease that to 1.8% by taking aspirin, that's only an absolute difference of 0.2%, which is marginal. But some people would express that as a 10% reduction in your risk of colon cancer. So when you hear that, you think, hey, that's pretty good. But then when you look at it in absolute terms, if it changes from 2.0% to 1.8%, then it's really not significant. And that's the issue with aspirin, is that when you're dealing with events that don't happen very often, a relative risk reduction of 10 or 20% in absolute terms is very small. And the general recommendation for aspirin is that if it is going to be used for prevention, whether it's cardiovascular or colon cancer, you only use it in people who have a higher than average risk of developing those diseases.
And as you said, there are risks to taking aspirin. I mean, Donald Trump seems convinced that he's going to keep doing it, even though he's certainly over 70, Fahad.
Yeah, it's look, the aspirin story, as Malcolm said, you know, it seemed promising. It just hasn't borne out. And once some of these things make it into popular culture, like this idea of aspirin for heart attack prevention, the benefit for someone like him, for Donald Trump, without knowing his health history, but let's say a general person like him, it's really not there. But this has made it into popular culture, and it's over the counter, right? So people just go out and buy it and they take it, and they say, I've been taking it for years. It's, you know, blah, 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 blah. They'll say, it's helping me. It's one of these things you encounter when you see patients and you try and make some suggestions, because, you know, using the very specific example of aspirin, it is implicated in gastrointestinal bleeding and other bleeding, even at a low dose. And the benefit is probably not there. And if it's there, it's so marginal and small, as Malcolm said, it's really not going to create a lot of benefit for people. And yet you see a lot of people taking it. So it's one of these things where we've lost a bit on the messaging front.
Okay. I'm looking at the clock. It's time to wrap things up. Thank you so much, Fahad Razak, Malcolm Moore, and Elisa Naiman. And we'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Okay, we're taking a break. When we come back, we'll talk about those massive demonstrations calling for regime change in Iran. They're peaceful demonstrations over the weekend here in Toronto, other cities around the country and around the world. What do they all add up to when we come back?
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, this weekend we saw massive rallies calling for regime change in Iran. They took place here in Toronto and around the country and around the world. And here the estimate was 350,000 people, a lot of them Iranian Canadians, peacefully demonstrating for that. Now, it had been my impression that this burst of action against the brutal Islamic regime was over because of the last crackdown, where thousands of Iranian protesters were killed because of that crackdown, and also because Donald Trump's trumpeting help is on the way never materialized. So I'm wondering, is that the case? Because I have seen reports that a military action is still possible. And the other thing I am curious about, having to do with these rallies, it looks like the Crown Prince, who is seen as a credible alternative, he's the one who called for these rallies all around the world on the same day, and you know, people answered the call. So let's go to Kaveh Sharouz, who is a lawyer, human rights activist, and senior fellow at the McDonald Laurier Institute. Kaveh, thanks for joining us.
Very good to be back with you.
So first of all, this looks like maybe the Crown Prince, is he the guy, in your opinion?
Well, he's certainly the man of the moment. I have to sort of put my cards on the table right away and say that I'm personally not a fan. I've been very, very critical of him of late. But, you know, I think it's undeniable to say that, you know, he is the figure that people are calling for in Iran, at least, you know, the ones that we hear. People have responded to his call for protests. You know, the massive protests that we saw on the weekend, for example, were at his invitation. So, I think he's got all the momentum at the moment.
And why are you not a fan?
I have known him and his team for many years, and I didn't actually have much to criticize. He says all the right things. It's that I think in the last few years, as he has gained more prestige and he's come to be kind of like a leading figure, he has created a movement that I think is not sufficiently inclusive, in my view, of different viewpoints. What I've been fighting for much of my adult life has been a democratic and pluralistic state to replace the Islamic regime in Iran. And I worry that despite the Crown Prince's language about inclusion, that's actually not the movement that he's building, that it tends to be very chauvinistic in a sense. It tends to be, it has authoritarian tendencies, which I worry about.
Interesting. And again, my perception, and I'm certainly very far from having expertise in this, was that, we've seen action against the regime and that this burst was over after the crackdown. So am I wrong?
Well, I mean, people at the moment in Iran have gone back to their homes simply out of fear. But the grievances that they have and the anger that they feel, those things are certainly alive. The grievances have not been addressed. This is a regime that simply can't address those grievances because in order to address those grievances, the regime has to change. And not only are those grievances still there, but now Iranians are incredibly angry at the level of violence that this regime unleashed in early January in response to the protests that took place. So now you've got a mix of just, basic grievances about the status of life in Iran, the economic problems, the lack of freedom, and so on. And on top of that, now you've got this incredible anger among the population. So even though things are a little bit quieter on the streets now, I have no doubt that people will be back on the streets soon enough. So that was just the latest round. There will be another round very soon.
Well, again, they're home out of fear, and who could blame them? What would it take to get them out of their homes? I mean, given that it's the same brutal leaders that are, killing them.
Yeah, so you alluded to the Trump statement a little while ago about help being on the way. I think that was something that really encouraged Iranians to come out in the street in early January, this feeling that perhaps the United States had their back. Regrettably, Trump didn't live up to his promise, but the negotiations that are taking place in Geneva at the moment, those things may break down and the United States may actually get militarily involved. I think if the United States does take military action against Iran by going after the IRGC, for example, going after the apparatus of repression in Iran, that might actually cause people to come back to the streets. I think they're now battle-hardened, the Iranian people. They know that, this repressive apparatus is going to be very difficult to beat. But if they have some help with that, I think they're ready to go out there and fight another day.
One of the things I'm reading about as a possibility is some kind of joint action from the United States and Israel.
Certainly possible. I mean, that's what happened during the 12-day war with Iran and Israel some time ago. They had obviously closely coordinated. Israel was engaged in the military action against Iran, and the United States stepped in. Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump have been meeting and have been speaking. So that's certainly in the realm of possibility. Iran's regime poses, frankly, an existential threat to Israel. So any action against Iran's regime would have Israel involved, I think.
Okay. Kaveh Sharruz, thank you so much for that. We're going to take a break and we will come back with more Fight Back with Libby Znaimer.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, we have been talking about the situation in Iran, the support of Iranian Canadians and Iranian members of the Iranian diaspora around the world. And right now, let's go to Salman Seema, who is a former political prisoner from Iran who lives in the GTA. Hi, Salman.
Hi.
So we saw this huge outpouring on the streets last weekend. And as I was saying to our previous guest, though, it had seemed to me that the latest burst of activity against the regime from inside Iran was over after a brutal crackdown.
So this fight has been started since 1979, the first day that the regime took power. And unfortunately, it's so sad. According to the last number, they have killed over 90,000 freedom-loving Iranians. And we all have in GTA, we have sisters, brothers, friends, cousins, close friends. When I talk with my Iranian friends in Toronto, all of them are affected. You cannot find anyone that one of his friends, one of his relatives doesn't receive a shot, or he doesn't lose one or two loved ones. So we wanted to show to our fellow Iranians that you are not alone. We are with you, and we stand for freedom.
But do you think that this round of freedom-loving Iranians trying to get rid of the regime is over, or what will it take to get them out of their homes and back on the streets? And what will it take to get rid of this regime, in your opinion?
So as you see that in the outside of the country's protests in Munich, in Toronto, in Los Angeles, in London, in many, many cities, we are all chanting the Trump Act now. We want military intervention. And President Trump promised to Iranians that the help is on the way. We are locked and loaded. I'm quoting word by word. So honestly, with empty hand, it's so difficult. And the unimaginable bravery that you saw it in many videos. So this is the time that we need action. We need targeted action, not just against Ayatollah, against all the IRGC commanders, against all those military bases that are oppressing Iranians people, Iranians women, Iranians youth. So if we have a meaningful support from international community, yes, the regime is very close to the end.
Yeah, but right now they're negotiating, and there's a possibility that there will be a new agreement with Iran. What do you think of that?
So, first of all, it's not Iran. It's an Islamic regime in Iran.
Okay,
so,
yes.
Always these brutal regime are negotiating. They are a master of killing the time. But on the other hand of the table, there is Marco Rubio. There is President Trump. They are a chief negotiator as well. So, jokingly, in Iranians' social media, when we don't know the answer, we say that, let's see what happened. Let's see. We make a fun of President Trump. So let's see. One option that we are ready, if we are ready, the Iranians are ready, if military intervention happen. And the other option is that if international community leave my people alone, we're going to continue the fight, and we're going to defeat this regime. Sooner is better.
Well, yeah, I would certainly agree with you there, Salman Seema. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for the opportunity. Have a good day.
Thank you. And now a bit of a hard turn in terms of our topics. So we turn now to affordability, the cost of living, retirement. And inflation isn't just driving up everyday costs. It's eroding Canadians' confidence in their retirement plans. And that is according to the latest BMO retirement survey. And nearly three quarters say rising prices have heightened their concerns about having enough savings. Two-thirds say inflation is already affecting their ability to save. And all of this is coming down as we are heading into tough economic times. And even people who want to continue working, well, they may not be keeping their jobs. So people, let me know, what have you found? Has this impacted your ability to save for retirement or to continue living the way you have in retirement? Food inflation is rampant. The text line and long distance phone line, 866-744-740, and our local phone line, 416-360-0740. And now let's go to Jamie Gollenbeck, the Managing Director, Tax and Estate Planning at CIBC Financial Planning and Advice. Hi, Jamie.
Hello.
Well, so how much harder have things become for people who may have been on track until quite recently?
Well, certainly inflation, particularly with things like food and basic daily living, has really hit certain of the population quite hard. And we're finding that not just in the BMO survey, but in other research that we've done, is that this is eating into both discretionary spending, but also long-term savings. And therefore, we are finding that Canadians are right now, some of them at least, struggling to try to balance these immediate expenses with a long-term view, or at least, setting something aside for that retirement side. So it is a challenge. We do recognize that challenge. And that's why we really do believe that people need to get financial advice and see if there are things that they could be doing, either on the investing side, on the spending, the goals, the budgeting, to help manage these very difficult times, particularly as it relates to, groceries and food inflation, things like that.
Well, exactly. So, I mean, what can people do? You've got to eat and you've got to pay rent or mortgage or whatever it is. You have housing costs.
Well, that's absolutely right. So obviously there's no magic solution for everyone, but I think that most people, at least in my experience, benefit sitting down with a financial advisor and going over their monthly costs, as well as, discretionary, non-discretionary items, from trivial things like, canceling subscriptions that you don't use that come up every month, from trying to, look at the grocery shopping versus eating out, like the simple stuff that we've talked about before, but to things that are perhaps a little bit more strategic. For example, if someone does have some savings, are they taking advantage of all the opportunities using things like the tax-free savings accounts to ensure that they're not paying any tax on investment income? Or if there is a little bit of savings, maybe using a dividend-tilted portfolio to get those tax-preferred dividends. So, there may be things that a financial advisor might be able to point out that might just be able to fine-tune that sort of daily spending and see if there's an opportunity there to still stay on track with that long-term goal of having enough to retire, or choosing the retirement age that's comfortable for you.
Let me give the numbers out again, people, if you have questions, or I am quite interested in hearing what the financial stressors are for you that may have blown you off your track. Is it the cost of food? Is it the cost of eating out? Is it the cost of helping out people in your family? The text line and the long distance phone line, 866-740-4740. The local phone line, 416-360-0740. Toll free, 1-866-740-4740. And Jamie, you're talking about people who maybe have not consulted a financial advisor. But what about people who have, and maybe people who are already in retirement but are finding that with these pressures, they can't make ends meet and they don't have new sources of income?
Yeah, certainly it's a challenge, and that's obviously important to, again, revisit the financial plan, look at the situation and say, you know, are there other potential, sources of cash other than, you know, income that you can tap into? So, you know, sometimes family members can help out if you're fortunate to have someone in that situation. Sometimes people will be expecting some type of inheritance, you know, in the future that can be a source of money. But also, you know, we do find, at least for some clients, is that they're very reluctant to tap into the actual capital that they've saved for retirement. And sometimes it is necessary, and it's not even a terrible idea. In other words, people are concerned about, yes, I want to, you know, have that capital last a long time, which is valid. And they want to live only off the income. But in situations like right now, if people are experiencing difficulties, it's not a crime to tap into some of that capital. And that's where a financial advisor can sort of sit down with you and say, hey, look, if we take out a few hundred dollars extra a month from our life savings, what will that do ultimately from a projection perspective? In other words, in terms of how many years I need the money to last, let's model that as well. So that for some people, that's an opportunity, not for everyone, of course. So, you know, it depends on your personal situation.
Well, a couple of questions arising from that. First of all, I've heard recommendations that people consult with an actuary. You know, how long do you think you're going to live? Do you have good genes? Do you have bad genes? It's probably sensible, but it does sound a little bit gruesome.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you need to go to that extent to actually hire an actuary. There's a lot of great software online, a lot of great websites. You could ask ChatGPT in terms of, you know, how old do you live based on the ages of your parents? I mean, I think recent research has shown that, in fact, family longevity is the number one indicator of your own longevity. You might work out every day and be healthy and go to the gym and eat well and be a vegan and all that great stuff, but at the end of the day, if unfortunately your parents died young, it's not looking good. So start with your family longevity, look at your longevity, and then, we run financial numbers modeling based on that. We sort of say, okay, you're already at this age, what is, your age? And then we sort of look, we try to take it up to a 90%, you know, chance that you'll live to that age. And depending, absent some major health issue, we often are doing financial modeling to people, you know, right up to 90, 95, you know, depending on their personal situation. So, yes, I don't think you need to hire an actuary, but we certainly use these type of actuarial projections, which are widely available on the internet, that you can just Google or use, AI.
Yeah, personally, I don't want to see what they'd say about me. Let's take a call from Pat in Toronto. Hi, Pat. I think we just lost Pat. Pat, you can call back. We're having a little glitch in the phones there. Pat always has some interesting financial advice. Is Pat coming back? I don't know. Again, the local number is 416-3. Yes, here he is. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Libby. So I'm a fellow tax CPA, and I've solved the problem because I'm still working at age 81. However, the real question is, as I turned 80, I looked up in the AI what the chance of making it to 90 are. And what do you think the chances are, just for anybody, a male, age 80 to make it to age 90?
I say it's over 50%.
It's 30%.
Oh, really? Because
that's it, 30%.
If you make it to age 80, you've passed a lot of the big right problems, and chances are you're going to keep living longer. So
there was a second study that came out last week that said that 55% of your longevity is a function of your genes.
Yeah, we covered that extensively, Pat. Okay, you must have missed that.
I heard it then. Anyway, but I still, the other last thing, though, you don't find any insurance agents calling at the door after age 80.
Well, yeah.
Enjoy.
That's true.
All righty, Pat. Thanks for that. Yeah, if you feel like going online and seeing what they have to say about your life expectancy. But it also raises another question, and I thought that the generation of baby boomers was different than the predecessors because people from the older generation, previous generations, were really reluctant to spend any of their money. And baby boomers, not so much. They're okay spending some of that money, but I think is part of the hesitancy at tapping into some of what you've worked so hard to save, you know, a psychological thing that you don't want to deplete it.
The thing we see most consistently, and it doesn't matter how much money people have, is they have a tremendous irrational fear of running out of money. We see this with average Canadians, but we also deal sometimes in the very high net worth space. These are people with millions of dollars, and they're not going to run out of money. And I assure them that. But they have this fear, and it's not rational. And, I think you're right. It's starting to change a bit with the baby boomers. But, you know, it is a mentality, and people are very, very worried about it. And that's really comes down to, I think, financial advice. I'd really tell people, meet with a financial advisor, run the numbers, look at longevity, and in most cases, not all cases, you'll be more comfortable than you think.
Okay, yes, that's an interesting, positive way to wrap things up on, Jamie. Tell me a little bit more about that. I mean, do you have numbers on the numbers of people that are actually better off than they think?
Well, I mean, just telling you, obviously our numbers are biased because if they're coming to see us, they're already working with a financial advisor. We don't know about the people that are not meeting a financial advisor. So, you know, most people that we see are better than they think. But again, that's not necessarily a broad survey of the Canadian population, many of which do not consult a financial advisor. And I really think that was one of the themes in the BMO poll, is that Canadians, some Canadians really, and I think the number one statistic that I took, simply 30% said they do not know if their money, how long their money will last. And that is the most worrying thing I took out of the BMO poll.
Okay, we should all find out. Very interesting information. Thanks so much, Jamie Gollumbeck from CIBC. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Okay. That's all the time we have for Fight Back with Libby Znaimer for today. Follow us on Instagram. Follow us on YouTube. I'll be back here tomorrow, and we'll talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.